Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of April, Mondays at 1, all things political. And our guest this hour is David Yepsen. He's director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He was with the Des Moines Register for 34 years, the chief political writer, political editor, and political columnist. The New York primary, its importance, and where things stand at the moment. The primary process for the Democrats and the Republicans, a lot of attention being paid to this recently. When did superdelegates enter the picture, and how do the parties differ when it comes to those delegates? In Wisconsin, Representative Glenn Grothman, when asked how Wisconsin could elect a Republican in the presidential election, said, "I think Hillary Clinton is just about the weakest candidate the Democrats have ever put up, and now we have photo ID, and I think photo ID is going to make a little bit of a difference as well." Todd Albaugh, chief of staff for former Republican State Senator Dale Schultz, characterized Republican senators in Wisconsin as being giddy about the idea of voter ID lowering turnout among Democratic voting groups. Wisconsin, of course, not the only state with more restrictions when it comes to voting. We'll talk about that issue with David. Paul Ryan's national campaign, New York Times, had an interesting piece from Page Story today. Confident America is his campaign. Is he promoting a battle of ideas, or is he positioning himself as the man to emerge from a brokered convention? Those are a few of the areas I thought would be worthy of our thought, and your ideas are welcome as well. Here's how you join our conversation for all things political, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. David Yepsen, great to talk to you again. Hi, how are you?
It's good to be back with you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, let's start with New York. How important is New York, David?
Huge.
That big, huh?
Coin a phrase. Well, this campaign is unfolding rapidly. It seems like just yesterday we were all talking about how Wisconsin might have changed the narrative of the campaign, and now today we're talking about New York and Pennsylvania as huge delegate wins for either for Trump and for Hillary Clinton. And I think that may get the campaign back on track for Clinton and for Trump. They both had a little bit of a rough patch in the campaign recently. There's polls out today that there are polls out today in both states that show the two of them ahead in their respective races. So I think if that holds, and we've seen where things can change at the end, but if that holds up, I would expect you'd see both pretty good victories for both Clinton and Trump when those states vote. And most importantly, we'll pile up considerable number of delegates for each one.
And David, why are both those candidates doing so well in New York and in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think part of it is both of them are from New York. Mrs. Clinton represented it in the U.S. Senate for some time. They're known candidates, and I think that has a lot to do with it. It's the same thing that's going on and has gone on all over the country. Mrs. Clinton fares a little better in those kind of environments than she has in some of these smaller states where caucuses can dominate and small turnouts can dominate the Democratic Party. And so I think the fact it's their primaries, I think that will help her more so than a caucus.
And the closed primary would be important for her as well, right?
Right. It makes it hard for somebody to get a mob of people together and go vote on election day, as it happens sometimes in these caucuses.
Mm-hmm. And let's look at the Republican side for a moment. It's interesting how Paul Ryan is popping up all over the place, all these videos he's taking on, promoting a battle of ideas. He's rising above the fray. What's he doing? Is he trying to sort of get the Republican Party together again for after the election, or is he indeed making himself the candidate for a possible contested election?
Do you think?
I think he is. I really do. Do you?
I do.
You do?
I mean, it's a no-lose situation for Speaker Ryan. The party is clearly unhappy with its choices now. At one level, he has got to set a little bit of an alternative narrative for Republican members of the House to coalesce around. If Donald Trump is the nominee, Republicans are already spending a lot of time trying to figure out how they're going to distance themselves from him. There are some experts who believe that the House of Representatives would come into play if Trump is the nominee. Regardless of whether it is or not, I think the Republican members of the U.S. House are going to be trying to distance themselves a little bit from their nominee. And Paul Ryan is giving them some talking points and a rallying cry. And there's a scenario where the convention deadlocks and they turn to Paul Ryan. I'm not sure that's all that likely. I think what's more likely is he's a young American political leader, and he is positioning himself. He's going to help his party as best he can now. And in 4 years, if Donald Trump is the nominee and Hillary Clinton doesn't get indicted on the email thing, the Republicans may very well be looking around for a fresh candidate to challenge President Clinton in 4 years. And Paul Ryan would be a logical choice.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the email situation with Hillary Clinton. The Washington Post had a piece today on the Morning Plum on Monday, and in writing about that, they say it remains a certainty in some quarters that some sort of email revelation that will destroy her candidacy is eternally just around the corner. Is it around the corner?
Well, it does hang over her head, and it's this drip, drip, drip
right. That
has caused her problems all the way through. I mean, you've got 140-some FBI agents who are looking into this case, and one school of thought says, boy, they must really have something. They're really going after her. That's a lot of people. And the other school of thought says, no, they don't have much, and they're making darn sure that they don't, because this is a very high-profile case. The president said over the weekend that no way is he going to try to influence the Justice Department and how what they do here. I believe him, because I think if he were to try to intercede in this, the FBI leaks would just drench us all. If the administration tried to do that, I thought it was interesting that Politico has a piece in which they looked at similar cases that have occurred with similar facts, and in many of these cases, the Justice Department does not indict. So, and the feeling of some of these experts that they talked to was that in all probability, she will not be. So it hangs over the campaign. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this process, the superdelegates and how the Democrats do it and the Republicans do it. As everybody knows, the backers of Bernie Sanders can't figure out why he's winning these states, but he doesn't seem to be able to cut into her delegate count because of her really overwhelming lead with superdelegates. The Republicans have fewer superdelegates, but I'd like for you to explain the difference here. We have a couple comments on Facebook already. Gene, I find the U.S. elections totally confusing. Why aren't the voting systems standard for each party? Delegates in some states are winner takes all. Some are proportional. Then we have superdelegates or uncommitted. Then we got the Electoral College. Surely we can do away with that. Make the party systems comparable and go by the popular vote. Time to change. And Matthew wants to know why Wisconsin superdelegates aren't going for Bernie.
Well, it goes back to the start of our country. The founders were worried about mob rule. And the small states were worried about the big states dominating. And so they made some compromises. And one of those compromises resulted in a U.S. Senate with two people from each state, regardless of size. And we have a House of Representatives based on population. So, and the Electoral College was created with the idea that wise men, primarily white planters, property owners, would get together and elect intelligent people to go cast their votes for somebody for president. What's happening in our campaign now is sort of baked in at the very beginning. There isn't direct democracy in this country. And certainly states' rights have played a role in this throughout our history. The two parties are really an affiliation of state party organizations. Each state has its own quirks and culture and political traditions. And that's all reflected in these complex and frankly, Byzantine nominating systems. To your point about in the Bernie Sanders case, the superdelegates originated after the 1972 McGovern debacle.
Mm-hmm.
In 68, the party opened itself up after the Chicago Convention. McGovern won in 72 on the strength of the anti-war movement. The party crashed and burned, lost in a landslide. And the party came out of that and decided it's going to put some people into the nominating process who know something about winning elections, who know something about governing, And those would be party officials, superdelegates, and they would be elected officials from the party in the states. And they're there by virtue of their positions, not because they want anything, but it was trying to cool off the passions of some great horde of people who come in and took over the party, as happened with the anti-war movement in 1972. So that's where they come from. It's been controversial, and many, certainly the Democratic Party, likes to have debates about rules, and I would expect that after this election, win or lose, the party is going to have some conversation about the role of superdelegates. But that's where they come from.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about photo ID, voter ID for a moment. This has been an issue in some states, and it really played out in Wisconsin in the aftermath of our election here. You probably know about this. Representative Glenn Grothman was talking about Wisconsin's voter ID. How could Wisconsin elect a Republican in the presidential election for the first time in more than 30 years? He asked, he said, I think that Hillary Clinton is about the weakest candidate the Democrats have ever put up, and now we have photo ID, and I think photo ID is going to make a bit of difference as well. And then I wanted to play for you, because maybe you haven't heard this one, which I find interesting. This was the former chief of staff to Republican State Senator Dale Schultz, who characterized Republican senators as being giddy about the idea of voter ID lowering turnout among Democratic voting groups. I want to ask what you think photo ID restrictions on voting in various states, including Wisconsin, why it's happening, and they seem to be pretty straightforward. Let me give you a chance to hear the former Dale Schultz staffer talking about this was on Chris Hayes' show on MSNBC.
I got involved as a young person. I was excited. And so I've been a Republican for a long time. It was that moment, Chris, in that room, in the Senate Republican caucus, where I heard people, a party that I had fought for over 30 years of my life, actually giddy and happy and talking about how we can take people's constitutional rights away, or at least impede them, in order to hang on to power. My God, it used to be when I was involved in the 1980s and 1990s, when you had governors like Tommy George Thompson in this state, when you had people like Scott Klug in Congress, when you had people like Steve Gunderson and Dale Schultz in the state Senate, we talked about ideas. We fought for ideas because our ideas were better. We thought we could move Wisconsin forward with that sort of thing. And now you have a group of people in the state legislature, particularly in the Senate Republican caucus, who want to impede people's voting rights. That's the point where I said, I can't do it anymore. I can't be a Republican. I can't keep going to caucuses because this party no longer represents me and what I believe in.
Are there people trying to impede voting rights, David?
I think that that's the net effect of what they're trying to do, and it's been done in other states. There's no real evidence that voter fraud is a huge problem on election day in this country. There's anecdotal evidence of it here and there, but I've seen a lot of studies that say it's not a problem. It is true that many of the people who do not have photo IDs tend to come from minority groups, lower income, maybe they're even senior citizens. All those groups will tend to vote Democratic in an election. So the effect of laws that, ostensibly to secure the ballot, really do have the political effect of limiting turnout of key Democratic groups. I think Republicans are after honesty in elections. And if it does reduce Democratic turnout, well, that's okay too. But I tend to think that this is more, as he suggests in the interview, part of a turnout suppression effort. It's happening all over the country, and you've seen it in the recent assaults on the Voting Rights Act as part of that, too.
Mm-hmm. Including the fiasco that happened in Arizona. That was terrible what happened there.
Well, there's a lot of horror stories around.
Yeah. So what happens with all of that? Does it wind its way to the Supreme Court eventually?
It could, and there's certainly, with the new Supreme Court justice coming on, there may be other litigation, other additional litigation. But for the immediate problem is what happens in the elections. And I think Democrats, they purport to be the party of shoe leather and the People's Party. This ought to be a warning shot. Ought to be a heads up. Okay, this is what's going to happen. They have ample warning in Wisconsin and in other states that this effort is going on. And the party needs to, if it wants to win elections, is going to have to redouble its effort at voter security, whether it's turnout suppression or incredibly long, fewer polling places, incredibly long lines there. I think that in close elections, those kind of things do matter. And one place where I agree with the Republicans is that Hillary Clinton is a weak candidate. She's got high unfavorables. That's just a political fact of life. Whether and many Democrats are concerned about it. It's sort of an underlying theme in the Bernie Sanders campaign that she can't win. We've already talked about the email things, her unfavorables. Democrats have been forewarned. They better start laying their plans now for what they're going to do to get people IDs and to make sure this problem's overcome on Election Day.
Well, what does it do to an election if you have two candidates who have very high unfavorable ratings, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
Well, for one thing, I think it could lower turnout. I think you'll see a lot of voters who just simply say they can't stand either one of them. Secondly, it does change the mix some of the turnout. And this is where I think that political scientists we're all scratching our heads. Donald Trump has shown a real ability to attract non-college working white voters. Traditionally, those have been Democrats. They became Reagan Democrats at one point. So the question is, does he provoke a huge surge of these kind of voters in battleground states like Wisconsin, like my home state of Iowa? I mean, if you add some new people that you're taking away from the Democrats, that can have an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the coin, he evokes some real antipathy among minority groups. And if, for example, his candidacy inspires a huge Hispanic turnout, and there are many Hispanics and Latinos of voting age who are not registered, it's been a real problem in that community. But if it prompts them to get registered and turn out and vote, if it happens in the African American community, then that could really help Mrs. Clinton. And I think too, the other problem that Donald Trump has are moderate women who in the past have been inclined to vote for a moderate Republican. They are not going to have anything to do with Donald Trump, and they could switch and vote for Hillary Clinton. So it's kind of hard. We know those things are going to happen if it's a Clinton-Trump race, but the numbers and what the net of it is, boy, that's graduate-level work here.
And you mentioned, I hadn't even thought about putting this on the list of things to talk about, but you brought it up, and now I'm wondering, the Supreme Court, a new justice coming on, what's up with that? Is he meeting with some Republicans now on the Hill? Is there gradual warming to at least embracing conversation, maybe having a vote? Where does it stand?
You know, I think the Republicans are so far dug in on this that it will be impossible for them to bring this up for a vote before the election. Now, it's interesting. You hear a lot of talk. Republicans are saying, well, we could confirm him after the election. And I think what the private talk is, most Republicans, mainstream Republicans, they kind of like the judge, and they would be inclined in a normal set of circumstances to want to confirm him. After the election, particularly if Hillary Clinton wins the White House, they're going to quickly confirm him. Because he's the known quantity, and he's a lot more acceptable to Republicans than Hillary Clinton's likely nominee will be. So I think that's where this stands right now. They'll dig in. Democrats will keep doing all they can to put their feet to the fire, because most voters in America think that the Senate should vote. It's a good rallying cry and battleground Senate races, such as the one in Wisconsin. It's even causing Chuck Grassley heartburn back in Iowa. He usually cruises to re-election, but they've got several Democratic candidates. One of them is a former lieutenant governor from a rural area. She's going to be, if she gets the nomination, she would be a formidable challenger. I'm not saying she would win, but she's going to make Grassley work like he's never had to work. So that's how the politics of this plays out.
Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them coming in. It's All Things Political you are listening to here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and our guest is David Yepsen. David is now director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He was with the Des Moines Register for 34 years. He was the chief political writer, political editor, and political columnist. Here's our phone number. One line is open if you'd like to join us, 800-480. 866-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Please put your comments on our Facebook page. We love to keep the conversation going online as well. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, phone calls for all things political for David Yepsen. And we start with Mike, who is a trucker, actually, in Kentucky. Hi. Hi,
how
Mike.
How you doing?
Good, Mike. How are you?
No, I'm fine. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Okay, what I think, and I've talked to other people, is an opinion going around pretty much. Our politicians, they are an embarrassment. And the news media, they're not much better. Just the news media wants to tell me what I need to think. Instead of them reporting the news, they want to tell you what you ought to think about it and try to tell you what's going to happen next. And we got our Congress up there. They won't even do their job. It wouldn't matter if the president has nominated six Supreme Court justices, it's still his job. He's still there. And they up there like a bunch of 15-year-olds that won't work, won't do their job. We got that going on. And I mean, it's an embarrassment. It's just this. And the delegates, the super delegates, that makes it so really and truly your vote don't count.
A lot of concerns there, David.
Well, I think he gives voice to a lot of the anger and frustration that many of us feel in this country. The institutions don't seem to be working.
Mm-hmm.
Congress, criticism of the media, courts, schools. I mean, I don't know any, the Catholic Church in Boston, for example. I mean, I don't know many institutions that get very high opinion ratings these days. Americans are angry, as he is, and Americans are also afraid. Many Americans who are losing their jobs because of trade agreements, they're afraid. We can talk about the economy doing much better if we have free trade agreements, and that's great if you're in an economics class, but if you're a 60-year-old Oreo cookie baker in Chicago, Illinois, who's just lost your job because it was sent to Mexico, that's not very much relief. That doesn't do much for you. And so I think there are a lot of Americans that are frustrated about all those instances.
So tell me about the disconnect and who's at fault here. Obviously, this has been going on for some time. The economy crashed in 2008. People lost their homes. People are still struggling with that. Their incomes are nowhere near what they should be when you look at inflation. So is it just that politicians are not hearing those people? They're not seeing what's going on? They're having conversations with big money donors? Or where's the breakdown here, David?
Well, I think it's all of those things. I think part of it has to do with elitism.
Really?
I think there are many Americans, many of us, who have good jobs and are doing well, and there are a lot of people who are not. And I think that there's a certain, unfortunately, we're as we diminish the middle class in America, which has been one of the great strengths of this country throughout its history, you're creating envy, you're creating anger, sort of a populist fever that's cooking out there. You add just the fear that goes on in the world about economic insecurity as well as terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Americans are afraid. That's not, Americans don't like to be afraid, but many people are. And so there, a lot of people, justifiably, I think, are getting angry about it. And a lot of them have come roaring into the electorate to vote for Donald Trump, in some cases, to vote for Bernie Sanders and others. That's the way we affect change. And you have to expect that the established order is going to push back. We're seeing that now in some of the delegate fights going on in various states, these superdelegates. Superdelegates are part of the rules of the game. And, you know, it's really not accurate to be complaining about them in the sense that Bernie Sanders and his campaign understood what those rules were before they got into it. So it's a frustration. And like I say, the Democratic Party is probably going to have to revisit this after the election.
And can you give us, David, a historical comparison to a time when we did feel down and out and it resulted either in historic political change or a change in philosophy of government or something that got us enthused again about the political process and our voices being heard?
Yeah, 1932.
Wow.
Go back and reread Franklin Roosevelt's inaugural message. That's where he famously said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." And so I think that that was an era where that we're not anywhere near a depression. Let me make that clear. But people do feel in a bad mood. We can't. I don't look at stock markets and unemployment rates. Look at right track, wrong track numbers, and do you feel optimistic about the future kind of numbers. And it's pretty clear that there's a lot of anxiety and fear. And our leaders, I think in many cases, have let us down, the institutional leaders of society. I don't know anybody that's happy about very many institutions at all. And until leaders speak to that, start restoring confidence, I think politicians would do well to make government work again, to make it deliver on services so people see that they get something for their money and feel like somebody's on their side.
Right.
So I think the best example that comes to my mind is the Great Depression.
Hmm. Mike, thanks very much for your call. Tony in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple concerns. First of all, we don't have leaders anymore. I mean, these people do not represent us. They're not our leaders. They're leaders that are beholden to the money that's involved in politics these days. They want to retain their ruling class seats, and the rest of us be damned. As for voter ID, all that is keeping people from voting so the ruling class can maintain their seats. They're making rules against the citizens who pay taxes. They're making rulings against us so we can't have a voice in our government. And I think that's where the frustration leads to, because nobody's hearing us down here. All they're hearing is the people they have dinner with on K Street, or all they're hearing is the people that are in Madison and that inner circle. They don't care what. We didn't need right to work. Nobody asked for that in the state of Wisconsin. Nobody asked for diminished union involvement in public employment. Nobody asked for a lot of those things. And that's what you're seeing these days, is laws thrust upon us that we didn't ask for. We don't have people who represent the citizens anymore. They're on their own agenda. And unfortunately, too many of us are being duped by those individuals.
So, Tony, does that make you, do you find anybody out there you can support, or does it make you just turned off to this election and politics in general?
I've talked to quite a few of my friends and colleagues and stuff that are being turned off by the way politics is playing, because they're not talking to the voters. They're talking around the voters.
Mm-hmm. David.
Well, he gives a pretty good voice to the frustrations that Americans have. I think Tony says it well. One thing, it's into the first part of his question about leaders and not just representing certain factions. One thing that would fix this would be nonpartisan redistricting. Drawing mm-hmm. of legislative and congressional district lines should be taken away from politicians and put in the hands of commissions or nonpartisan groups. Because the systems that we have now in many states result in congressional seats and legislative seats that are safe for one party or the other. So what do you do to win a seat in the legislature? If you're a Republican, you pander to those conservative interest groups. If you're a Democrat, you pander to groups on the left-hand side of the spectrum. And then you get nominated and you win your seat because it's a safe district. And there's no incentive in that for you to reach out to independents or for you to reach across party lines to try to compromise with somebody. In fact, there is a penalty if you do that. If you come out of a safe Democratic district, you get penalized for working with Republicans. And the problems in this country, and certainly it's true here in Illinois where I'm working, you're going to have, everybody's going to have some pain. You're going to have Democrats who are willing to make some cuts, and you're going to have Republicans who are willing to raise some taxes and some revenues. I think that that's true at the federal level, too. But you can't get that kind of compromise with the legislative and congressional districting systems that we have in most states in the country.
But there are. Is it just a handful of states, David, that have changed it to bipartisan districting?
More and more are.
Are they?
Yeah. California has, Arizona, Florida. There are more and more states that are moving in that direction.
Let's go to Tony. Thanks for your call. Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi.
Can you hear me?
Barely, Rod.
Yeah, I was trying to call Joy Cardine this morning, and I didn't get on. And he said they could barely hear me. But anyhow, if you can hear me, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, this thing with the emails and that, you know, maybe it's a legitimate thing, you know, but I'm just wondering if they're going to do that. Am I obsessed or too critical to find out when they're going to indict the powers that be that were flying the Bin Laden family back a few hours after the Twin Towers were hit?
I don't know that anyone that there is any indictment like that in the works.
I haven't heard anything about that either. And what about the email situation? We had people tell us that the Washington Post corrected themselves. There are now 50 FBI personnel involved. KP did some research on this. But are they going to come up with any kind of decision before the election? Do we have any sense of that with the emails?
Well, I think a lot of people hope so. My experience in covering Justice Department investigations is that they don't come out and give a blessing and say, no, you're innocent. They just don't do anything. And so there's a scenario in which Clinton and the Democrats are going to be still feeling like they're being left out, hanging out there. I think in this case, though, that the Justice Department will have to say something about what it's decided to do with this investigation.
Robbie in Nishikoro. Hi, Robbie.
Hi. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out why it is that I can vote for somebody and it doesn't make a difference. Like in the state of Wisconsin, I voted for Donald Trump. Hate to say it, but my vote doesn't mean squat. Trump didn't get beat by the percentage that, of delegates that Cruz has won in the state of Wisconsin. So why don't the people of Wisconsin count for anything? When it comes to the presidential election, one delegate or one person wins. He gets all the delegates. Why? Is it, if it's 60-40, shouldn't it be six delegates and four delegates? Why doesn't Wisconsin do something different?
Yeah, the parties, we talked a little bit about this earlier. The parties do this somewhat differently, don't they, David?
Yeah, the two parties do. I think Republicans have a lot more flexibility in what their party leaders do. In some states, they're bound to vote for a certain candidate on the first ballot, and then they can do what they want to afterwards. It's much stricter in the Democratic Party, and there is a stronger requirement of proportional representation than there is in the Republican Party. Look, the Cruz people understand the rules. They played the game better at the conventions. And that's the answer to his question about why his vote in the primary didn't seem to count too much.
Let's talk a little bit about Bill Clinton, who was at a campaign rally in Pennsylvania, I believe, and has drawn some concern about the comments that he made concerning the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 94, not what he said about that, but what he said about super predators. Here's Bill Clinton, and we'll talk about whether or not the Clintons and Hillary Clinton might be saying to him, stay at home for a while, husband. Here's what he said.
I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. She didn't.
What do you think? Too much made by the press of that, or does he need to be a little bit more careful about what he's saying?
No, I think he needs to be a little more careful.
Yeah.
I mean, We've all seen our spouse say things we wish they hadn't, and I'm sure Mrs. Clinton feels that way today about Bill. He's always been a wild card element in this campaign. We've never had a candidacy like this where the spouse of a former president is running. He can be a lot of good to her in various settings, but here you see an example of where he kind of lost his cool. He said later he wishes he hadn't said that. The optics of that with him pointing his finger at that woman are terrible. And this hurts her with an African-American constituency that she, up to this point, has done pretty well in and needs to have a big vote out of. Maybe Bill have to go home and do the chores for a while, for a few days, so he cools off.
Do voters separate the two?
I think they do. at one level, but at another, no. The Clintons have always kind of presented themselves as a package deal. I mean, how does she distance herself from that? It's not like he's a governor or something like that who says that. It's your spouse. It's pretty hard to distance yourself from your spouse politically.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Robbie, for your call. Julian Appleton, hi.
Hi there. I would like to get your opinions on why is it okay, like, for example, you're talking right now about, you know, he shouldn't have said that or whatnot. But Donald Trump is saying freely what he thinks about Mexicans, about Muslims, about, you know, the black community. I mean, why is it okay for him to say such offensive words and languages and use language that is harsh and it creates hatred, it creates a fear with those populations? And he's rising. Every media, you know, coverage is on Trump all the way, you know, focused on him, and he's getting a lot of popularity that way. But why did other, like Rubio and other people, if they would ever come out with a comment like that, they would be criticized and they would be, like, out of the game? Why is it okay for Donald Trump to say all that stuff and then the other ones can't say nothing because they'll lose their you know, path to the White House?
David?
I think that's because voters and because media people sort of hold these candidates to different standards. Donald Trump got a lot of coverage early on because he was a celebrity, and no media people did not take him as seriously as they should have, and he got a lot of coverage because he said these outrageous things, and that became a news story. It is also true that if you have Donald Trump on your program, your ratings go up. And that economics of ratings has driven a lot of this fascination with Donald Trump. Now, he does pay a price for this. He has a lot of opposition. He's very rarely won majorities in these primaries. Most Republicans in most states are voting for someone else. He's a plurality candidate up to this point. Now, that may start to change in New York and Pennsylvania when he breaks through 50%. But he sort of got a free ride on some of this stuff early on. He was funny and outrageous, and people were tuning in. And then as he started to grow in the polls, his opponents were fractured. He starts picking up some delegates, and nobody's been able to slow him down.
Mm. What did you think about the Boston Globe front page story, deportations begin, the sort of mocking Donald Trump? Did they go over the line or not?
No, I don't think so, but that's going to be a big debate in journalism. It was run on their ideas page. It was not their real front page. It was effective. It's having the intended it to be effective. It wasn't just some milquetoast editorial about Donald Trump. They took his words and they wrote headlines and news stories, mock headlines and news stories about it. And it's provoking that discussion. And that's what you expect a good newspaper to do on their editorial page.
We're listening to and engaging in a political conversation this hour with All Things Political. David Yepsen is our guest. David is a longtime political writer, chief political writer, political editor, and political columnist. So he has some historical reference as we talk about this election. He's covered many of them, was with the Des Moines Register for 34 years. He is now director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. We have a couple lines open if you've been trying to get through to us. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nathaniel in Milwaukee is our next caller, David. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hi, thanks for having me. One of the things that I want to remark about is a lot of two-facedness and how that, I think, could be really upsetting to voters. And for a couple examples recently, you had Charlie Sykes get on national TV and present himself as a defender of civility and seeing through scams, when he was on national TV as to how Cruz did so well here in Wisconsin, yet right after the most recent election that he had an impact on at the national level, he was actually making comments that one could take as insulting to City of Milwaukee voters themselves because they had voted away he didn't want in a city election here. So I think there's a divergence of presentations, and one thing that your guest may not get it all, but I wonder a little bit about is how a lot of people outstate might look at Milwaukee as taking in money, yet one example of the state spending money in ways that could actually hurt the city would be with a proposed freeway project that'll take a lot of money, isn't really wanted in the city, would seen as hurting the city tax base, but would cost statewide a ton.
All right. Thank you. And our guest is in Carbondale, Illinois, so we don't expect him to be real familiar. But I do want to pick up on the role of, because I do think in this particular area, and when you look at the counties that are in the listening range of where this conservative broadcaster is from, they did that, Ted Cruz did very well, that they did help the race, I think, the victory of Ted Cruz in the state of Wisconsin. Do you want to talk about the role of particularly conservative talk radio in other states and in this election, David?
Well, it's true. They have had influence. They always do. But the problem with the conservative talk radio audience or the anchors and the hosts of those programs, they were often divided among themselves in other states in who they supported and how they treated the Republican candidates. And so they weren't providing as much leadership. Now, it's my understanding that in Wisconsin, they all did kind of start talking about Cruz,
yes,
and supporting him, and the result of which is they did have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
I think Wisconsin voted at a time when a lot of other candidates were out of the race. The race was starting to clarify, and it's significant that when you got Trump with another Republican or maybe three, that he started to lose, and Trump started to have some troubles. The problem with stopping Donald Trump is that no Republican was able to get him in a one-to-one contest soon enough, and the result is he's starting to pile up a delegate lead.
Let's go. Thanks, Nathaniel. Marianne and Crystal Lake, hi.
Hi, Wayne. I just wanted to say that it's great you have somebody from the Paul Simon Institute, because he's in a lot of people's minds, I think, like the last statesman, if you were to ask,
right,
who you think about. Well, there's so many people, it's so confusing, but that's a name we all remember. But I just didn't comment backing up with the Clinton thing, what he said. I respect that. He kind of spoke his mind, because you always get the feeling that maybe years ago when he started to campaign that's how he felt, and then, you get kind of put into the system. He's a younger person with a lot of elder statesman, and he's just speaking his mind, I think, as a grandfather. You go into another channel when you have grandkids. It's not about yourself after all, and I think it's maybe redemption, and I I'm not a big supporter in that way, but I thought, good for him, he spoke his mind. And I if there was a that would make Hillary more important to me than she's ever been, just the fact that he's speaking his mind, because this is a real danger. We're from Chicago and we see it, and we're fourth generation and don't like it, but it's like, what can you do,
David?
Well, I think that's an interesting way to look at it, and I had not thought of it that way. I guess I think that the fact that Bill Clinton said he probably shouldn't have talked that way was evidence that it was politically not useful. But it was a refreshing bit of candor. He seemed to be a little bit angry.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, though, that doesn't work in his favor, if you look at it politically, is what did happen. Obviously, there was a problem, but these huge incarceration rates and three strikes and you're out, and the whole change in policy and the private prisons that were built, et cetera, is to defend that when she's running a campaign that is in very many ways opposed to that, the two don't jive on it. And so, obviously, there's going to be criticism, right?
Exactly. And the fact is, she has to count on a big African-American turnout in this election.
Right.
That particular issue was an
right.
enormous one in that community.
Yeah. Maria in Milwaukee, hi. Maria, go ahead. I'm sorry, Maria, call us back. Can't hear you. Victor in West Allis. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Enjoy your program, like always. Hey, I just want to bring a little history to people. In 1986, in the mid-'80s, when the Congress decided to give immunity to the 11 illegal aliens that came to this country, and people would say, well, wait a minute, 20 years from now, we're going to go through this again. And then Congress said, no, we're only going to do it once. And I'm getting to wonder if they do it again, if 20 years from now, we're going to go through the same problem. I think Congress is going to put its foot down. So regardless of what the politicians say for coming for president, I don't think Congress is going to move one bit on this one. What do you think?
On immigration reform, no, I don't. I don't think that that bill is going to go anywhere with this Congress. And partly for the reason you suggest, one Congress can't bind another 20 years from now. And who knows what the Congress that sits a generation from now is going to want to do about this issue.
Thanks for the call. Mary sends this email about the ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. She says, since ALEC has had great success in the states with Republican governors, what role do you think they are playing in the election process at the national level?
Well, I think ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, is a significant conservative force in American politics. Their focus is aimed at the states, not much so much at the national level. But the question I've always had is why progressives and Democrats have not formed a countergroup to rise up and meet ALEC, because ALEC has had a lot of success in the states.
Well, Democrats haven't been very good about organizing at a state level, have they?
No, they really have not, and that was brought home to them in the 2010 elections.
Yes.
Republicans are holding more more legislators' districts than they have since 1920, and that happened to be the one that drew the district lines, which assures that Congress stays in Republican hands for this decade. I was surprised the Democrats sort of dropped the ball. They're trying to do something about it now, but they're clearly behind the game.
Yeah, they are. A lot of catch-up being played. Mary in Richland Center. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for the program. I'm wondering if you think there's any correlation between Bernie not taking Milwaukee County, even though he won in Wisconsin. Is there still a longstanding prejudice against Jews in the black community?
I don't have a good answer for that question. I don't know the politics of Milwaukee well enough to be able to comment on that.
Well, how about nationally? It's about animosity among people in the African American community, racial tension with Jews or not?
I don't see evidence of that in showing up in any of these elections. I mean, Bernie Sanders does not make a big deal about his faith, and I think the vote that Hillary Clinton is getting from African Americans is because of the long track record that she and her husband had with African-American voters. I mean, you'll remember he was once called the first black president. And so I think it's more of a positive thing for Mrs. Clinton. Yeah. I just haven't picked up on any of that anti-Semitic feeling that she was describing.
And if you were, we have about 3 seconds left, if you were advising Bernie Sanders, would you say yes, go to the meeting at the Vatican, or no, stay in New York and campaign?
I think you should go to the Vatican.
Do you?
I think if you don't now, it would be seen as a real rebuff.
Uh-huh. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. We'll call on you again before this election happens. David Yepsen, our guest, he's been with us before. Longtime reporter, great reporter for the Des Moines Register, 34 years. Chief political writer, political editor, political columnist. He is now director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. And we thank him for his time. Thanks for all of your calls and comments. Just a reminder, we talk a lot of politics on this show, but every Monday at 1 o'clock, it is a program that is all things political. Tomorrow at this time, we'll look at the results of one of the first major surveys that focuses exclusively on parents' views on education, what parents are thinking about the state of schools. The survey is the result of Pathways in Education, a nonprofit that provides dropout recovery and prevention programs.